Survivor's Guide to True Crime includes discussions of sexually based violence and is not intended for children. Information provided should not be used as a substitute for professional medical or legal advice. Please exercise discretion and self-care. Welcome back to Survivor's Guide to True Crime. I'm Kim.
And I'm Kara.
Thanks for joining us here. We have a little announcement. This is actually our final episode of season one.
Yeah, there's been a little bit of an unplanned extended break for us, and that's just because life, honestly. I've been more or less traveling for 4 weeks, creating life and doing keynotes all over the country. So between that and other things Kim has going on, this last episode was just delayed.
But don't worry, everybody. We will be returning with a season two, and we will let you know as soon as we have the date for that return. We're banking our episodes and still doing all kinds of content and interactions over on Patreon, so you can always join us there. It's patreon.com/SGTC, and we'd love to see you there.
I'll also say, too, really quick, we have some excellent guests already lined up for season two that you will not want to miss.
Yes. Oh, man. I'm so excited for some of the people that we met at the conference and some of the things that we have planned and some of the things that you guys have been asking for and just so much goodness, as always.
So we are excited to bring you this episode today and talk a little bit about what we had already pre-recorded. So here it goes.
I'm getting over a little bit of a tickle in my throat sort of deal. So bear with my voice as much as possible.
I probably had something and gave it to you and then left.
Yeah. And then just peaced out. I was like, this is probably a product of being around so many people or just Kara.
It's me. Yeah. Like I know everyone here, there's like RSV was going around really bad, but I never got it. So unless I did and I just didn't know.
Surprise.
Surprise. I'm sorry.
It's ravaging my lungs that never quite healed all the way, but that's okay. Yeah. We shall not say the word. That word shall not be named.
Yeah. So aside from that, we were together last week.
I know. We've got lots to recap.
Yeah, we do. So we so much happened and yet not a lot happened. We drove Mike crazy talking about the shapes of our nails for approximately 3 hours, according to him.
Which is actually about, oh, guys, we spent 4 minutes, maybe tops, yeah, on this. In his, yeah, mind, that is 3 hours.
Yes, he was full of angst because he said he didn't want to listen to our inane banter any longer. Talking about the shapes of our nails and our colors. And
we were sitting on the couch together doing our nails because we were going to be presenting the next day. And he's sitting on the other couch. And you just hear him audibly like, we kind of look at him. He's like, I'm just trying to decide if I want this to be the next hour and a half of my life.
Yes. And then we tried to get him to sit on the couch in between us. And he was like, absolutely not.
No, wouldn't do it.
Yeah.
He enjoyed it, though.
Yeah. So then as he rehashed that story, it became us talking for an hour and then, you know, the length of a full length feature film. But yeah, so we did that and we drove Mike just a little crazy. We didn't annoy him too bad. And then podcast movement, yeah, went great, I think.
Mm-hmm. It went so fast. We had half an hour on the stage that we shared with Christine and Anna. If you haven't already listened to that episode with them where we talk about ethical true crime and give kind of a sneak peek of what we were talking about on stage, that is the chapter right before this one, I think.
Yeah,
probably.
Who's
in charge of this? Who's keeping us in line?
Yeah, no one. No one could, no. As if.
No one.
I talked a lot about having approximately 2 brain cells that are just swirling around inside my brain. Sometimes they get close enough to rub together and little synapses start firing and conscious thought comes out, but it's not often. So, but even with my 2 brain cells, I feel like the panel went really well. It was received very well. We got to make a lot of connections with people that we had talked to via email or online in various forms, and it was good. We, yeah, got woken up in the middle of the night by fire alarms twice.
Got to go all the way outside, stand out there, watch people looking down at us from their rooms. You're going to burn alive. They didn't.
Yeah. Well, come to find out, those people may not have also had the fire alarm. So we can judge them slightly less harshly. No judgment.
Not at all, because the second time it went off, we're sitting in the room. We're like, ah, obscenity. Are we just going to stay in here? Should we just ride it out? Really thought about it.
It was so loud, though. There was no, there was not really a possibility of that. So, and then got to Lazy River.
That was not a lazy river.
It was Fast and Furious.
So the Gaylord of the Rockies has like a, quote, water park outdoors, you know, when the inside isn't collapsing. And we went one whole lap around the not so lazy river, and there's a waterfall part that you have to go through. And our dreams of having our hair look semi-decent for the next day went right out the window.
Yeah, because we had the conference and then we had photos the next day. So we were trying to not wash our hair. But yeah, that didn't work so well. We went to Cured, which is our podcast sponsor. And they're in the process of moving to virtual and moving their warehouse. So there was not a ton to see, unfortunately, but still got to meet Gina over there, who is in charge of all their socials and worked on a little bit of content. They did a little giveaway for me, for my followers on Instagram. And they're just fantastic. And then got our amazing photos that you guys hopefully saw if you follow us on Instagram. And they will also be a basis for some future merch, too.
Heck yeah. And I just want to say a huge, huge thank you to my friend Caroline, who was our photographer for what we are now calling our lesbian maternity shoot. Because it's like best friend exploring the wilderness. Also, Kara's pregnant, and it looks like it's hours together. Step aside, okay, Joe.
But you don't have any photos with like your hands on my belly. So why did we do that?
I don't know. Let's do it next week because we're going to be together again.
It's true. Yeah.
No, but she made this, oh my gosh, she had so much thought that went into it ahead of time, just completely nailed our brand and our vision, and we have the backdrop of the Flatirons, and it just ended up being really cool, and we're in a like old school convertible. It was a vibe, man.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. So even though I was just like super uncomfortable by the end, but I rallied a little bit.
I want to explain this. This week that Kara was here, we went and picked up snacks, first and foremost. Very important to keep her fed.
Yes.
Kara has to snack many times throughout the day.
Yes.
But also does, nothing sounds good.
Everything sounds awful.
But she knows what doesn't sound good.
Which is not strictly just a pregnancy thing. I will say I've always kind of been this way off and on. I don't really know the cause. I've never been able to figure out a trigger. But yeah, I go through phases where foods just don't sound good. And I'm incredibly nauseous this pregnancy. And so it just kind of amplifies it. But it also leads to one of the things that I thought was funny is we've talked about ADHD and how Kim and I have ADHD. And I don't know, I've probably alluded to at some point how I think that I mean, who knows? Is it trauma or is it autism? I don't know. I think I might be a little bit on the spectrum just because of like some of the things that I know that I do. I'm just really good at masking. So one of the things that I thought was funny is there were several times when Kim would say like, oh, Kara's grumpy. And I'm like, no, I'm actually fine. I'm just not masking. So it's like
you were either hungry or just kind of staring off. And I was like, she's not mad. She's content. But like in a way that you will understand, new person.
Yeah. And how you can tell that I was like just not masking. Well, first of all, when I don't have an expression on my face, I look really pissed off. So, but I'm like just sitting there like while we're waiting on photos to be taken with my RBF. And then like a bike goes flying down the hill and I'm like,
it was like it's like the spinning wheel loading for a long time and then squirrel.
This is just me. Like, this is me not masking. I don't know. Sometimes it's two brain cells just kind of, and sometimes it's nothing.
Do you know how many times, though, since you said that week, I have thought about it and I'm like, I'm not grumpy. I'm just not masking. And Michael even say, what's wrong with you? I'm like, and I don't think anything's wrong. That is the exact words I need. I'm like, I'm just not masking.
Yeah, I'm just not pretending to be happy.
I'm just used to constantly having them in a fixated smile.
And it can be very off-putting for people who maybe only know us from our public persona or yes. people who don't know the real us, people that we don't feel safe enough with, or people that just aren't the same as us. And yeah, the more I learn about these things, the more I realize it. And I'm like, oh, sometimes I'm just not masking. And mm-hmm. that's okay. Like, there's nothing wrong with that. So I just thought that was funny.
I also thought the funny thing, when we're changing locations, Kara is clearly uncomfortable, like going to be nauseous, needs to eat. There was a storm that came through and it kind of threw off our timing. I was like, okay, Kara needs to eat. Where are we going to eat? She knew the things that she didn't want. I ended up just picking a place, having you drive to it so that you didn't get sick. I was passenger princess in my own car. And I just heard, you're staring at the menu like, I just picked something.
I was like, all of this sounds awful.
She had, what is that called? Just, it's like that major indecision where nothing sounds good, but you know you need something. And so I just picked based off what I knew she was sort of looking for. She paid for it, ate some. We were back at it.
Yeah.
It was, I'm sure Caroline's looking at us like, what is wrong with these two?
I know. We had to like take turns parenting each other a little bit.
Yeah.
So it's kind of funny. It just made me laugh. Because there were multiple times where I was like, hey, Kim, you haven't eaten enough food. That's mm-hmm. not a meal. And you were like, okay, I'll eat.
Yeah. Oh, God. Well, and then she ran, my photographer heart gets this. She was so excited about the shots. She ran home and started editing as soon as she had her kiddos in yeah. bed and started sending us these sneak peeks. And we're like, oh, these are epic. So I can't wait to update our website and some of the images that you guys see on the podcast player that you're probably looking at now. So there's just a lot of really cool things to come. See what happens when we can actually be together.
Sometimes a lot, but also we did not record while we were there.
We didn't even really make videos.
No, I don't think we really made a single video other than just like sporadic content.
We did live and we did.
Yep. Oh, we did a live.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
But yeah, when we are together, it's just we are
not masking,
not masking and in our moment.
Yeah.
The next day was supposed to be a down day. Spoiler alert. It wasn't. I took Kara on a trauma tour of my hometown.
What's a trauma tour, Kim?
Oh, funny you should ask, Kara. This is where we're going to start off by driving to the courthouse where my rapist was prosecuted. Next, let's go meet the prosecutors on my case. Oh, here's also my husband. Let's go to lunch. Here's the place that I worked in college. And then let's drive. Let's drive to the apartment complex so I can show you the apartment that was also a crime scene. And then let's drive to my parents' house where we can hang out with my mom and she can show us her large binder of all of the insurance claims and incidents following my assault.
It's fine. These are totally normal things.
I would also like to point out there are reasons that we are getting all of this stuff together and out. And I showed Kara right before we started recording. My office floor right now is littered with evidence. I have all of the evidence from my case, photos, transcripts, all kinds of things that I am preparing to package up and send away, which is a little nerve-wracking, but will be awesome. So stay tuned.
Yeah. Yes, yes, yes.
And then we got up, took you down to the airport at 5 a.m. I was like, okay, see you in like 2 weeks.
It was so early. Yes. And for anyone who didn't see the video of our dark humor that I posted, that was like the retelling of something that happened at the conference where someone came up, talked to us, and Kim was like, oh man, he had serious serial killer vibes. And I was like, really? I didn't notice. But we've already established that I don't pick up on those. So... Like, I don't pick up on serial killer vibes. It's a thing. I don't know.
I feel like when people overhear us saying shit like that to each other, they're like, oh my God. Can I laugh?
Should
I
yeah. call someone? No, you can. You should definitely laugh. It makes me, I think all the time of that Ted Lasso thing where he's like, I hope that's a joke. And if it's not, I can't wait to unpack that with you. It's like episode one where he says that. And I'm like, I love Ted Lasso so much.
Like, I forgot about that.
Yeah. He's like, I can't tell if you're joking. I think that's what he said. I can't tell if you're joking or not, or something to that effect. I don't know. I don't have a photographic quote memory like some of us.
That is just on full display, I swear. Every time we're in person too, or talking for long amounts of time, where I'm just interjecting all kinds of stuff from, you know, two decades worth of videos and movies and just random pop culture references that have weaseled their way into my mind and everyday
conversation. Yeah.
Yeah, just everyday conversation. Oh, and we watched The Sweetest Thing.
Which was just like a mad trip down memory road. Memory road. See, there's those two brain cells.
Journey.
Memory lane. I think that's it. I told Kim, I didn't realize how many things in that movie had like formed me. They were formative things in my life. Like I still do the like chop it up. Like when I'm going through a crowd, that's from that movie. Like there's so many things.
He is P-I-S-E-D. Peist? I say that. He is Peist.
There's so much about that movie. And I mean, I feel like it aged fairly well, but it's like 2002. Is that what you said?
Yep. Yeah.
Okay. So if you think of like There's Something About Mary, yeah, that version of comedy, but it's like a girl's movie.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. If you haven't seen it, it's funny.
A bunch of absurdities just strung together that people just thought of funny scenes. And then they're like, wow, this could be an interesting segue.
It's so bizarre. Like the number of things that happened in that movie, you're like, how did they fit so much into one movie? Pretty funny. It's almost like a spoof.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's good. Other things. I have no segue for this. Other news that we maybe should have led with. Hey, I'm having a girl.
Yay.
Yeah. I know, right? Sorry, you just had to listen to us yabber about before I said this. Found out on Tuesday it's a girl, which is what I sort of expected, but I didn't want to be like, oh, it's definitely a girl, just in case it wasn't. So yeah, little baby girl.
Yes. I was over here like, it's absolutely a girl. No questions asked.
That's pretty much what everyone has thought. But yeah, had the ultrasound. She was wiggling all around in there, bouncing, karate chopping. And she has very, very long legs. And she is just so cute. And I'm still not, my kids this morning were like, how many weeks pregnant are you? And I was like, 19. And they were like, and how many weeks is it total? I said, well, traditionally it's 40, but I basically went to 42 with both of them. And they were like, so you're almost halfway. I'm like, well, not really. Still got a few more weeks until I'm halfway if we're counting to 42. So I still have like 2 weeks until I'm halfway. And they were just like, so you're still going to be pregnant for how long? I'm like, a long time. Yeah. Like, how do you think I feel?
Kids don't typically find out as early as you were willing to share either.
Right. I told him what I knew the day I found out. Yeah. So, I mean, I told everyone basically the day I found out or the next day. And then also I sent Kim a message this morning, right?
Yeah.
You know, they have all these funny things that you can compare the size of your baby to. And the one for this week was the baby is approximately the size of a zucchini. And I was like, I don't believe it because Kim's zucchinis in her garden are the size of a femur bone. Approximately.
Oh my God. No, and the meat and thigh around said femur. They're humongous. And it's not as if I'm just letting them go forever. So we checked the little garden, in quotations, right before we left to go down to Denver. We stayed one night, came back, went out, checked the zucchini. It was, this isn't a fish measurement or like a mic time measurement. Yeah. It was probably 18 inches or so long, huge, had grown into the wire fence. I'm like, how did I do here?
Yes. Yeah.
What am I supposed to do with this mini zucchini?
Yeah. And it
the first
and
then, one.
I think the best part is you talking to your daughter about it. You're like, you know, this don't expect all zucchini to be this size. You're going to have very false expectations.
Can I tell you, she saw one in the grocery store. She's like, why is this so small?
Oh, just.
I was like, this is not a good way for me to.
You're like, oh no, honey.
Don't like this with you.
Like, don't expect them all to be that large. You'll be disappointed for the rest of your life. It is alarming, okay? Alarming amount of zucchini.
Yeah, yeah. It's pretty absurd. And tomatoes. And tomatoes. Like,
oh my God, did I send you the picture?
Yes, but I was like crying laughing. Like bushels of tomatoes.
So many. Mike went out and got them after this weekend. Also, side note, Mike's brother got married this weekend. It was wonderful up at the cabin. Glorious. So perfect. We got home after the weekend and there is a massive, like huge, large, big thing, like popcorn or mixing bowls.
Four basically of them. A 5-gallon bucket full of tomatoes.
Cherry tomatoes. Cherry.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, on one of my other pregnancy apps, it was like, the baby is the size of an heirloom tomato. And I was like, I call BS because the other one said it was the size of a zucchini and like 9.5 inches, or like almost 10 inches long. I'm like, I ain't never seen a 10-inch long heirloom tomato. Like, what you talking about?
Who's making this up? Men or meteorologists?
Right.
It's got to be one of the two.
Like, none of these are the same. This is why I have 3 different apps that I look at every week where I'm like, what's the real deal?
Major optimist vibes.
Yeah. Seriously. Anyway.
Oh my gosh. We've just been chattering away. So next week, we are in Fort Bragg together to give a presentation. Very exciting. So you can expect more lack of content. More videos. More lives. We can do lives again. That was really fun. But we actually get to be back together for that. But today, our episode is not just us inanely bantering. It's actually really important. And I loved this conversation for so many reasons. So our friend Sean Johnson joined us. He has an Instagram handle that's The Sane Corner, Sexual Assault Nurse Examiner, which is what he is. He's a forensic nurse. He does a lot of training and he'll tell you all about his background. But this was exciting because we opened up the opportunity to you as listeners to ask questions of a guest ahead of time. So you'll hear him answer a lot of the questions that were submitted, mostly via Instagram, I think. And there were a couple on email as well.
Yeah. Sean Johnson is a dedicated registered nurse passionate about providing compassionate and patient-centered care to survivors of sexual assault, domestic violence, human trafficking, and stalking. Sean has been a sexual assault nurse examiner since 2018.
Since becoming a SANE, Sean has made significant contributions to the field of sexual assault care and advocacy in Maine. His role extends beyond conducting forensic examinations. He also plays a crucial part in educating his community and other healthcare professionals about sexual assault, domestic violence, human trafficking, and stalking prevention, and the importance of a trauma-informed approach to care and services provided to survivors.
Sean's career as a SANE began in Portland, Maine, where he worked as a registered nurse before specializing in forensic nursing. He developed exceptional clinical skills in assessing and treating victims of sexual assault while training colleagues throughout the hospital about the role and the services SANEs provide.
In late 2021, Sean started the SANE Corner Instagram page to create a community and bring awareness and education to social media about forensic nursing.
His passion for providing specialized care to vulnerable populations led him to pursue an advanced degree, and he is currently procuring a master's in public health. In addition, Sean has a passion for breaking the stereotype that men can be SANEs and that more are needed in this field. This is one of my favorite things about having Sean on is that we wanted a SANE to be on the program, but the fact that he is a man that is a SANE, I think provides an additional side of this sexual assault nurse examiner field that you may not be aware of.
I really enjoyed this conversation with Sean. I know that you did too, and I think it's going to be really educational. So here it is. Sean Johnson, welcome to the podcast today.
Thank you both for having me on.
We are happy that you are here and that you have graciously given us your time and your expertise. We have been on here talking about a variety of different things before this. So we're switching gears and we're getting very professional now, sort of.
We're going to try.
Yeah, we're nothing if not consummate professionals around here.
So we start each episode off with an icebreaker, as I know that you've heard. Sean was going through and doing a little research before he hopped on here and mentioned that he was listening to, what was it? Ghost Farts.
It was the Ghost Farts one. Yep.
Cool. So again, keeping with the theme of professional, what is your most recent binge, whether it is movies, books, TV, podcasts, you name it?
I actually have 2 binges right now. One is my textbooks because I am in school for my grad. And so textbooks is one thing I have to binge every single day. But for TV, my last binge has been Good Omens, and that's been my last binge.
I don't know what that is. Tell us more.
It is on Amazon Prime. It stars Michael Sheen and David Tennant. The one is a demon. The other one is an angel, and they're best friends. And they stop the apocalypse with the Antichrist. And it's a very comedic and really funny show. And very British.
This is right up our alley. Yeah. Anything that's like escapism and fantasy, Kim and I are 1000% in.
Then you both will definitely like this show here because it's really good.
That's awesome. We will add it to our Amazon Primes, to our many streaming services. Okay, tell us a little bit about who you are, how you got to where you are today, to your comfort level. Introduce yourself to our listeners.
So I got where I am completely by accident. Nursing is a very second career for me. I actually was a loan officer for a very long period of time. And then the mortgage crisis of 2008 hit. And I was let go and I was very selfishly looking at what careers can I get into that are recession proof. And so growing up, I was in and out of hospitals for like medical reasons. So healthcare always fascinated me, but I never really had the drive to it. So I went back to school. I became a medical assistant first, just because nursing school waitlist back in late 2000s was about 4 or 5 years long. So I worked as a medical assistant first, and then I went back to nursing after doing that for about four years. And then I went straight into the ER, took care of a lot of patients. And then I just saw a flyer for a SANE course. And I had no idea what that was. I spoke to my manager because she is one too. And I'm like, tell me about this. This looks very fascinating. And when I was talking to her about what the role is, kind of learning more, there was a little bit of pushback because it's something that I did want to pursue, because most of people who work in this field know that female identified patients are the ones that really come in and seek care. And so there was some pushback because of my gender about like, would I be accepted in this field, right, as a sexual assault forensic nurse to provide that level of care? I eventually did go to the course, did everything that I needed to do. I got credentialed, and I've been doing work as a forensic nurse for a little over 5 years now. I no longer am at the bedside. I am actually at a college with a goal to kind of bring forensic nursing up within the state of Maine to train more nurses right into this field. Because the sad reality is within Maine, unfortunately, there is still a number of hospitals that don't have anyone who's even gone through our training to become a forensic nurse within their setting. So my drive now, after coming into this field completely accidentally, is to kind of grow the next gen of forensic nurses up. Not just within Maine, but also nationally too.
What amazing work to just kind of, you know, stumble upon too. For Kara and I both, we had interactions with forensic nurses before we ever knew what they were. And I'm assuming that's probably normal for your patients as well. When you see them, when you were at bedside, what was that first interaction like? How do you approach those situations?
I approach those situations with a lot of tenderness and care, because the person that's sitting in front of me is there after experiencing the worst thing that has ever happened to them. And I don't take that lightly by any means here. I take as much time as they need. I present myself in a very open and compassionate way. I do certain things inside of the room where I don't stand. I sit below their eye level. I fully inform them, like, this is everything that we can do. And I check in with them throughout the whole entire process and allow as much time as needed to answer any sort of questions that they have about what I can offer, like what that looks like, the time frames, and even some resources for afterwards, as soon as they leave the hospital, because unfortunately, that's the only time that I'm going to have with them. So I don't take that lightly. And part of my approach to it is I know that coming into the hospital is probably one of the hardest things that they are ever going to do. And it's an honor that I can be that person to kind of start that healing process, to help them take that first step. And sometimes it is that first step that is that hardest step. And I don't take that lightly by any means.
So let's start from the very beginning here, because I know that we got a couple of questions about this. What is a SANE?
So Hussein is a sexual assault nurse examiner. And each state, I will say that each state does kind of have their own laws and rules around it. So some states do things a little bit differently, some don't. So I definitely say if it's something that you're looking into within your state, something you want to learn more about, definitely look at what your state rules are, because they do vary from state to state some. The training in Maine does look a little bit different versus some other states. So the training that I went through, it is a 40-hour didactic course where we learn all of the ins and outs, a lot of the nuances with it, followed by a clinical sim day where the program has models that also work in this field to act as a patient for us to learn those clinical skills, to kind of learn how to use a speculum, right, as well too, because nurses aren't trained to do that within nursing school. And then there's some other clinical stuff that we have to do throughout the course of the year after that training is done, and then we are credentialed for 3 years within Maine. I know in some states it does look a little bit different, so that's why I say always check to see what your state laws and rules are, because it will look different.
We are so thankful for all of your support. We're also supported by Cured. They are a supplement company that is changing the industry standard for how supplements are made. They are products that I use every day that have genuinely changed my life.
Kara, of course, is the one who introduced me to them, and I was a little hesitant at first, but I can say after using their products for the last couple of months, I'm hooked.
My favorites that I think everyone should try and will love are the Serenity, Zen, and Rise. Serenity gummies have ashwagandha, L-theanine, and CBD. They're going to help you to just relax, take the edge off at the end of a long day or whenever you need it. Zen is going to help you fall asleep, stay asleep, and sleep soundly. Hallelujah. And Rise is going to give you sustained energy and focus without caffeine or without a crash.
I was really hesitant to try anything I view as a sleep aid, but I can say after incorporating Zen into my nighttime routine, I am getting such better sleep.
Yes. And for all of our listeners, you can use code KARA10, go to curednutrition.com or go to the link in our show notes to take you straight to the website. We hope that you love it as much as we do.
So let's also then talk about the secondary part of that. What happens after that patient is gone? What does your role look like then?
So my role, it varies. It varies because in Maine, one thing that is really good is that patients have the choice if they want to report or if they don't. And that choice is completely theirs. If the patient wants to report, I do inform law enforcement that I am taking care of a patient. I give no info that they would like to report a crime. And that's all that I'm saying to them and having them come in. My charge nurse usually would bring them to a different room so the officer can take that statement there. While I'm packaging up all of the evidence that I collected that the patient wanted me to, and then I turn the evidence over afterwards. If the patient is not reporting, I still do my same process with the evidence, and then I have the officers come and pick up that anonymous kit. And I will also work with the advocate that is in the room when the patient is there to kind of help with safety planning for when they leave, just to make sure that they do have a safe place to go. Are there resources if they can't go home to find some place for a night or two before a family member can come and pick them up? So I will work hand in hand with them as well too. So one thing that I do that I can do as well too is that I'm highly trained to testify in court. It's something that in the 5 years that I've been doing this, it's something that I have not done yet, but I do help with the DA's offices within Maine. I do help train some of the brand new DAs that have never tried these cases, as well as bring in brand new forensic nurses for that training. And it's more of a team training on how to testify, but also gives the brand new attorneys time to practice and find out like what questions can they ask versus what they can't ask. Because we do have sometimes we do have someone acting as a judge, and that's usually someone from the DA's office who's very familiar with the process, acting as that judge and course correcting the brand new attorneys as they are learning their process when prosecuting these trials here.
That's brilliant. Mm-hmm. Oh my, I'm sitting here thinking about how invaluable that is on the prosecutor side. Like, yes, for forensic nurses, but like baby DAs that are going through this and maybe haven't done a case of this magnitude yet, they can be nervous about this too. I think that's really important to familiarize here. You know, you think of this very cold, hardened system, but those are people that are doing that too. And everybody has to have a first time. So how cool to be able to take that training to them in an environment that is safe to learn.
And not only that, but it gets them familiar with us and familiar with what forensic nurses do so that when they see one of our charts that they get in because they are moving forward with prosecution, why we do some things that we do. It may not be what law enforcement wants or what they want, but they have a better insight on the care that we provide and that we can speak to that care very easily on like why we do things a very certain way.
One of the things that you told me in a previous conversation is about the different certifications, which you touched on, how they're different state to state and how there are some increases in who can become a forensic nurse examiner or a SANE. I guess it wouldn't be a nurse examiner if it was a doctor or someone else, but talk a little bit about that because I think this is really interesting and has a great potential for helping a lot more people.
Yeah, definitely. So Maine and some other states, they have what's called a SAFE. Now, SAFE and SANE, they are interchangeable. The training is exactly the same. But in some states, they only want to focus on nurses doing it. So that's where the SANE part really is focused on. But states that have SAFEs, the training is offered to nurses, to nurse practitioners, to physician assistants and MDs and DOs, and that the same training that we get as nurses is given to them and they can become credentialed to do this type of work within the states that do offer SAFEs. Not every state does. I don't have a exact count on how many offer that, but it is a great way to expand this role. Because there's such a need for people just to get into this field, to be able to provide the services that survivors need, because it is very specialized care versus someone who's coming into the ER for shoulder pain or something just like this. This is a highly specialized field. It is a very heavy field as well, too. But the more people that can get into it, it's just better outcomes for survivors, better care for them as well, too.
I'm just thinking of how beneficial it would be to have something like that in a health department, for instance, or in an OBGYN's office, places where people are already going, they're familiar, they're comfortable, if they don't have to go to an emergency room and a totally different environment if something happens to them. I love that we are making those advances, and I would love to see every state incorporate that into their protocol because I just think it's, like you said, it's just better care for survivors.
Mm-hmm. Well, and think about all of the different things that you learn throughout the course of this training. It also makes you a better advocate, even if you aren't just with a patient. I'm thinking about all the ways that you can apply that compassion and empathy and trauma-informed care in every aspect of your life. It makes you a better rounded human.
No, it definitely does. And I mean, we can all think of a time where we've gotten care or gone to an urgent care with a family member, a child of ours, or even ourselves, where we've just have had awful, awful care. And going into this field, even taking the training, even just for the education side of this, it's going to change how people practice. It's going to really open up their skill set to identify some responses of trauma, how to respond to those without re-traumatizing the person that's sitting right in front of you. So the more we can open that training up to everyone within health care, the better it's going to be for every patient that comes in, no matter what the patient is coming in for, because it just opens our eyes much, much better.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Kind of on the same vein, we had a question from a follower and they wanted to know, how often do you see children or teenagers? So we know that adults would come in, and I know it's probably different by state to state jurisdictionally, but that was a question that someone wanted to ask.
So I have taken care of a couple really young ones. I'm not going to say ages. I don't want to put those numbers right out there because I don't want to traumatize or trigger anyone that is listening, but I have taken care of some really young patients, yes. I have taken care of quite a few teens. And so it can be difficult. I'm not going to lie. Sometimes it is hard, but the training definitely prepares you for some of it, yes. Some of it you kind of do learn as you go, because everyone's situation and story that they are telling you is going to be very different. So I have taken care of some really young ones, and I have taken care of a lot of teenagers, yes.
Kind of on the heels of that and just the job in general, how does it affect you?
For the first couple of years, it really affected me a lot, because I became a forensic nurse in the middle of 2018, worked a year and a half, and then COVID hit on top of this. And so still providing the forensic care now with all the COVID stuff, being an ER nurse as well as a forensic nurse. So there was a lot of compounding traumas going on. There's a lot of hard stuff inside of the ER. I mean, we saw a lot of COVID for the first 6-7 months and a lot of death because of that, before the vaccines and so on. And then also being pulled off of the floor because a patient came in needing my specialized care. So trying to kind of lock the door of this hard patient because of COVID and their vital signs are not looking good. And now having to stop that and shift focus on this, there was a lot of compounding trauma that happened. So the role, depending on what else the forensic nurse does, it can compound a couple of things. Self-care is a huge thing. I preach it in every single training that I give to nurses, to NPs, to really anyone who will come to any of my training sessions. I will preach self-care to people, tell me to stop. Because if you can't take care of yourself, if you can't recognize the signs in yourself that something is activating you, there's that trigger that you kind of don't know what it is, but you know that internally you feel like something is off. If you can't realize that in yourself, providing very high sensitive care to somebody else, it's not going to be as effective care, because you can't recognize your own trauma and what's going on inside of yourself.
That's very well said. And that goes even beyond just nursing. Mm-hmm. You've got to be able to recognize that within yourself. Yep. And a lot of times it's everyone around you recognizing it first. Listen to people when they reach out.
Yes. Start by believing is key. Not just for the patient that you're taking care of, but also yourself as well too.
Oh, expand on that, because that gave me chills.
Okay. So yes, start by believing. We definitely need to believe when loved ones, friends are telling us things. We can't minimize that by any means. But we also need to start by believing what we're feeling. Like what has happened to us did happen to us. It's not supposed to happen to us. We need to believe ourselves so that it can help our own healing process as well too. Because without believing in yourself, believing what happened to you, no amount of therapy is going to help that. That's just my personal view on right on that there. We need to believe ourselves so we can also believe other people as well as the communities that we live in as well.
I mean, yes. Thank you. Thank you for saying that. It's so important. And I think we don't want to downplay that it's hard to do sometimes. It's mm-hmm. hard to even learn how to hear your own voice sometimes. And then once you hear it, it can be hard to believe it. So if you're listening and you feel like you don't know how to hear your voice or you don't believe it, then I think that's a good place to start.
Well, it just felt like a part of me was validated too. So thank you, Sean.
You're welcome, Kimberly.
I don't know if you guys know this, but like we learn something and or we get convicted or healed pretty much every episode in some way, shape, or form. So if you feel like you have those moments, know that we have them too.
Well, and not only that, think of nursing. Nursing is the heartbeat of healthcare. Mm-hmm. And that's what we do. We give so much of ourselves to every patient that we come in contact with, and even some of the other people that we work with. We give so much of ourselves out, and sometimes we don't have the energy for the self-care or even to believe ourselves. But I'm saying you have to shift some of that focus back onto yourself so that you can heal yourself so you don't become burdened with everything else.
So Kara did something great where she did open up questions from our audience. Mm-hmm. We would love to rapid fire some of those at you.
Oh, fire away.
So if you are a student or looking to change careers, what would be that piece that you're like, if you've got this drive or you have something within you, what is that thing that you look for to say, yes, go for it, do the thing?
I definitely say first, if you want to go into this field and you are in healthcare, definitely work in the field minimum of a year first. Get those assessment skills down cold, because with this type of exam that we do, it's not just a focused one. It's a full head to toe. So I say always work in the field for minimum of 1 year. Some states do make you work in the field for 2 years. So definitely check what your state rules are. Get those skills down, because those skills are going to be so vital in what you're going to do as a forensic nurse. With that also being said, don't be afraid now to start talking about the uncomfortable. I don't want to say live in the uncomfortable, but don't be afraid to start talking about it with the colleagues that you work with. It's something that healthcare has not done the best job on, is to recognize a lot of this stuff. So start talking about it. Annoy some of your coworkers. I've been told to stop talking about it numerous times, and I still don't. So don't be afraid if you have that drive. And not only that, there's so many resources out there that really explain what the role is, explain what we do. There are Instagram pages. There are the International Association of Forensic Nurses and the Academy of Forensic Nursing are two fantastic sites that give some education on what the role is. Not only that, but some of the stuff that we see within that role. So if it's something that you're looking into, definitely start searching on those two sites and some of the Instagram ones, because so much info is out there that can give a very clear, clear view of this.
Do you work as a forensic nurse for the hospital or for the police? And if neither of those, who do you work for?
In my state, we are a nurse and we work for the hospitals that employ us. Forensic nursing is not a part of law enforcement. I know it has that forensic aspect to it, and that is a misnomer. That is a huge, huge myth. They hear forensic, they think CSI, Special Victims Unit, and police. We are healthcare, and we work for the hospitals that employ us. That may be different in other states. Some programs are housed right out of their AG's office. However, they're still nurses. That is what their role is. We do not work for law enforcement.
Sometimes during the commission of a crime, a sexual assault, there's not always a physical injury. What would you say to people who say that there is always some kind of physical evidence that an assault occurred?
I say that that is completely wrong. And part of that is because of media and movies. I mean, there are some great shows that do talk about sexual assault, but the problem with some of those shows is they always show the victim battered, bruised, bloody. That's not the case. Sometimes in an assault, yes, there may be a small bruise here, a small abrasion there, but the mass majority of the time, there's no physical injury that can be seen during our exam on the patient. Our body is designed to accommodate a lot of things. Think of childbirth. A uterus grows. That's where the child is formed, in the way that leaves our body. The body is designed to expand, stretch, to lubricate as a protection method. And so it's a very accommodating what our bodies does. And that's why the mass majority of time, there's no injuries that we can see.
So what if you've got a patient that comes in and halfway through the exam, they decide they don't want to do this anymore?
Then we are done. We don't question. We talk to them. We reground them. We check in with them. Because with the exam that we do, the person in front of us is in complete control. We will not do anything the patient does not want us to do. We will not look at anything that the person does not want us to look at. And the person has full authority in that room. It's not about what I want or what I want to do, or based on what they told me, what I know that I can collect as evidence. It's really about what their view and what they want done. And that is what we are doing.
One of the very first questions I got from a follower that I thought was very profound, it was actually a forensic nurse examiner who said, how do I handle these situations when someone wants to leave, but they also want to prosecute, knowing that when they leave, there goes all of that evidence and likely the chance that they will be able to successfully prosecute. And I said, well, I think you just have to let them go. And I think it's very tricky, but I'd love to hear your take on it.
My take on it is the patient's choice. If the exam is activating them and is triggering something and they feel like they need to leave, by all means, let them leave. They can always come back. That's the beauty of ERs and even those standalone sites that offer this service. If the patient feels like they need to leave, let them leave. I know internally it breaks us apart. It's very hard for us because we know internally and thinking about like, I know all this evidence I can collect. I know what I can do for this patient, but what I want to do, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. And that's a very hard thing for healthcare and nurses to really understand that's like, yes, we are an advocate for our paid patients, but we also within this role, we really need to give the voice back to the person who's sitting in front of us. Because it's not about what we want. It's not about what we can do. It's really about what they want. And I can't reiterate that enough, that they may feel like they have to go, let them go, but also let them know they can always come back, regardless if they want to report or if they don't, they can always come back.
So this is a common question that I get asked after keynotes or speeches or trainings. What if you don't have insurance? Or what if you do have insurance, but you don't want a policyholder or a family member or an intimate partner or someone else to know that you got an exam? What does that look like?
It does look different in every state. A lot of states do have victims compensation funds. In my state, if someone comes in and I just break the seal on the evidence collection kit and just do one very simple swab, or even collect a sock or something so easy and simple, Maine Victims Comp will fully cover that exam. There is a billing form inside of the kit. The hospital fills it out and it gets sent to Victims Comp. Nothing goes to the patient whatsoever. That's my state, though. I know in other states there are victims comp funds. Some of the rules and regulations may look very different. So I always say look to see what your state has and kind of what those rules are. Because unfortunately, what happens in my state is not going to happen in Colorado or South Carolina or New Hampshire that's right next to me. It's going to look completely different from state to state. So I say look at what your victim comp rules are, because that will kind of help with that as well, too.
In Colorado, I know that whatever jurisdiction the sexual assault or contact is being reported in, it will go to that law enforcement agency and they cover the cost. There's also victims' compensation. If you have primary insurance, it can be billed there, but it does not have to be. And that is something that you can say to your nurse examiner or the hospital. It's like a liaison, financial liaison or whatever. Those are the last things that you want to be thinking about. Yep. When you take someone in. And this is why we like to speak to people who are advocates for their friends or family or safe people. Like, this is why we harp on resources over and over again. If you know these things going into whatever situation may present itself, you're going to feel better prepared and like you're not chasing your tail when you actually just need to be present for that survivor or for yourself.
Agreed. Completely agreed. And not only that, the advocates that I've worked with know those forms and know the process for the additional funds for certain things as well, too, in and out. Not only that, the director of the fund works really close with our like training program and does the education for new nurses as well, too. So we know if anything comes up, we can call her and she's fantastic. So that's my state. I wish it was the same in every other state, but unfortunately, it's just not.
When I worked as a primary victim advocate and I did like on calls overnight and I was dispatched out to sit at the hospital with victims who were going through these resources, I want to make it very clear that if you go in for an exam, it does not mean that you automatically have to report. Even me as a liaison with law enforcement sitting there, I had a person who decided I don't want to report. And that did not mean that my services ended there. I am still all the way through that process with them, but you don't have to report to go in and get that done. You're going to hear about what's commonly called rape kit backlogs. What resources do you point to that are doing a great job of ending those backlogs or helping with tracking for victims? I know I'm kind of putting you on the spot here. I've got a couple in mind, but I want to hear what yours are.
No, I'm making the face that you can probably see because unfortunately, when it comes to kit tracking, Maine is the only state that does not have a kit tracking system. That's something that all of us forensic nurses are working on currently, but unfortunately, we do not have a tracking system within Maine. So I know that's not the case in other states. I've seen some of the tracking systems. I've seen and they're phenomenal. Unfortunately, Maine is the only state that does not have one.
I did not know that until right now.
Yeah, and I do know because of the way that the law is within my state here. If it's an anonymous kit, the evidence locker within the police station by Maine state law at this moment has to hold it for 8 years. In a couple of months, that's actually being bumped up to 20 years. So if a patient wants to report, then the evidence is sitting there and it does not matter within that 20 years when they do, the choice is completely theirs. So I know that there are some precincts that do have a mass majority of kits inside of their evidence lockers because not every kit is tested within Maine. We don't have a tracking system.
Here's another one. And this question is from a longtime listener, also a host. Who could it be? It's so weird.
I wonder.
So talk about what the collection looks like on offenders or the accused or alleged defendants.
That's actually a great question because we do have suspect kits. That's what they're officially called within Maine. I personally have never done one. A lot of the forensic nurses within Maine have not done one. Usually when it comes to those, if the offender is male, usually law enforcement will collect those with another male officer doing it. If the offender is a female, that's when they do bring them written to the hospital because there are certain areas that police officers just are not going to do. And I fully understand why, but there's only probably been a handful that within Maine that have been done within the hospital setting.
And correct me if I'm wrong here too. If those suspects are already in custody, it would be the Department of Corrections and maybe their medical staff that is doing that, or is it just law enforcement investigators before it gets transferred over that part? And that's nitty gritty, I know. But
it depends on the setting. So if it's someone that they're trying to either rule out, or if it's someone that like, we have all this evidence, here's a subpoena, it could be they're in the precinct before they get transferred out. It could be after they are transferred out. So it does vary based on where they are at that time.
So I'm thinking to when I was investigating these types of cases, and I'm thinking of my coworkers and myself, and I never saw actually a suspect kit that had evidence that had been collected. And so I'm thinking through what was done in those cases. And I think usually it would be when the person would come in for a statement, it would be, can you just swab your cheek? You know, mm-hmm. Like we would ask them to do that voluntarily. And that was usually the case because investigators are pretty good at what they do. They're very good at least the ones I worked with, they got a lot of confessions, I will say, and a lot of voluntary and like nothing sketchy, a lot of voluntary buccal swabs, like all the things, and just pop that right into evidence and compare it to what we had. So yeah, now that I'm thinking of it, like I've seen a suspect kit, but it was empty. You know, it wasn't, there was no evidence in it. So I forgot about those.
Well, and as I'm thinking through too, we've got like, obviously Karen and I both have pretty much all of the evidence from both of our cases. Mm-hmm. I have a DVD of the interview of my attacker and they get his buccal swabs right there. They did some photographs and stuff. Ooh, which also brings me to another very important point.
Yeah.
That is divisive. Buccal or buccal? Which one do you use? Because I've heard, preface, I've heard both of them are fine and it's interchangeable, but there's a right answer.
I say it's the same thing as potato, potato, tomato, tomato. We all in healthcare know exactly what that means, regardless of how you pronounce it or say it. And so I personally have no preference. It doesn't, I know what they mean by hearing both ways. So it's like,
right.
It doesn't matter.
I said buccal for forever and somebody corrected me and it's buccal. And then I changed it and they're like, no, it's buccal. I'm like, I don't know what to do with my hands.
It's tomato, tomato. It's like, it doesn't matter. Yeah. We all know.
For the people who don't know, who are listening, they're like, what is that? It is a very long Q-tip that you swab the insides of your cheeks and just like.
It's not that long. It's probably about 6 to 7 inches.
That might be long for some people, Sean.
Well, that is also true.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
If you're thinking of the Q-tips that you get at CVS, It's a little bit longer.
COVID length. It reaches your brain through your nose.
Yeah, actually, that is the best way to put it. It is the same size as the COVID swabs we've all had done. It's that length. It is not those big cervical swabs that are like 18 inches. No, yeah. It's not that big there. No.
I'm sorry.
The dark humor, like the places we could go with it. This is why people listen to us, hopefully, because of this right here.
Yes.
And it just immediately, I unlock those videos of like the men on TikTok. They're like, we got like 4 inches of rain. So like, that's like a lot, right?
Yeah, right. Like that's a lot. That's meteorologists and dudes with highly lifted trucks that'll never see dirt.
You would not believe the amount of lifted trucks in Maine.
I might.
But granted, we actually get more snow than you.
Oh, yeah, you do. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, for sure.
Oh, I can get dark and twisty too, so don't worry about that.
Yeah, oh, we know. We know. I should also say, I know that we're like almost to the end of the episode here, and Sean and I know each other from before. Do you guys remember Anna? She's our mutual friend. Mm-hmm. We met at In Violence Against Women International conference in Chicago, finally in person. So like, this is not the first time I'm meeting Sean, and Kara got to talk with him beforehand. So this is...
Yes, because I was Mike's stand-in because he was being pulled away, and Anna got pulled away, and you said you were his stand-in. I'm like, okay.
All right.
That's awesome. I feel like the dark humor, like we say this over and over again, like the people that get the dark humor are especially the people who work in these fields. Because I think mm-hmm. that was a question that, I mean, overwhelmingly, when I put out these questions, the question I got the most was in some way, shape, or form related to how do you not take this home? How do you deal with this? Do you have secondary trauma? Like just all of mm-hmm. these things. And it's like, well, dark humor is part of it because sometimes you just have to, and it's not laughing at situations or at people, just at the absurdity of what we are doing sometimes.
Yeah. And I fully agree. I mean, definitely some of what we hear within this field, it does stay with us. It will stay with us for the rest of our lives as well too, even though the trauma did not directly happen to us. So that secondary trauma and that vicarious trauma is very, very real. But it's also getting your self-care routine down, knowing who your support system is, who you know you can go and talk to, be completely open and honest with, and they're just going to sit there and listen, not say, well, you should try this, but just listen to what you are saying, just to let you just get it out. Finding a place in nature is a great thing as well too, or just a space that you know that I can sit in silence here and just enjoy the sounds or enjoy the breeze or the sunshine and just decompress internally. So definitely getting that self-care routine down. I mean, dark humor is part of self-care as well too. And we all know that. And so just getting your routines down.
It's making me think through the law of energy, right? Mm-hmm. Energy can't be created or destroyed. It can only be transferred. And I think this is a lot the same with trauma. If you're taking on negative experiences and trauma and all of these different things, it's up to you to decide how you're going to transfer it. You've got to work on it within. You've got to make it into something else. And sometimes it's going to come out as dark humor. Sometimes it's going to be transferred by you talking to someone else. You decide how it's transferred. It's not going anywhere. You've got to decide what to do with it. And so you're not destroying it. And hopefully you're not creating it. But we get to decide how we transfer that to ourselves and to others.
Fully, fully agree with you on that. Yes. Yeah.
Sometimes I sound smart. I just came up with that in my brain.
I think it's great.
Good job, Kara.
Yeah. I don't even have all my coffee yet. I want to hit at least one more of these questions because I really like this one. What particular skills from other types of nursing have been helpful for you during the SANE process?
Most of my time in healthcare has always been either in urgent care or in the ER. So I'm very used to the fast pace and sometimes that is a benefit and sometimes that is not a benefit to forensic nursing, because in that type of a setting, you are going to see some very hard things. People coming in from car accidents, you are going to see some gruesome things. You're going to hear some hard stories just with medical care. But I'd say definitely ER nursing, OB nursing, urgent care nursing, and floor nursing, really anyone that's in nursing that has direct patient care that is assessing the patient, you have the skills to become a forensic nurse. You have the skills to provide that care, not just to the patients that are coming in seeking that specialized care, but also to any other patient, right, as well, too, because a lot of people that work in healthcare don't recognize that every person that we are caring for has some sort of trauma within their lives. So this training and this specialized care as forensic nursing can definitely be transferred to every other aspect of nursing too, because we don't know when trauma responses are going to come out, and they come out so differently because trauma affects everyone so differently. So really, if you're a floor nurse, an ER nurse, or an OB, a urgent care, anyone that is directly caring for patients, you have the skill set to venture down this road here.
So one thing I know that we had talked about previously that I want to hit on, if you are in a rural area, let's talk about it from the nursing perspective first. What are great ways to get that additional training or to learn more, even if maybe you don't have a forensic nursing program available to you?
You can definitely reach out to the International Association of Forensic Nursing because they do have an online course. I know that the Academy of Forensic Nursing have their courses as well too. But also check with your board of nursing within your state or DHHS within your state, because in some states, that's where the programs for the state is really led out of. So there are avenues that you can go down to kind of see where training is, what you have to do. Some states offer it only online. Some do both in person and virtual. So reach out and just look at your board of nursing and DHHS within your state, and also reach out to your AG's office, because the programs may be run out of there. And then they can give you all the info that you could ever want on trainings and so on.
Another one that's also available that we know of is the virtual practicum. For listeners here, Sean had said he has not had time to go through this. I did the marketing and video work for EVA when they were putting together the virtual practicum. And what that is a 19 and a half hour course for people, not just looking to do the nursing aspect of it, but maybe for prosecutors or advocates to get a better idea of what this life cycle of what forensic nursing and evidence collection looks like, completely free. It's grant funded. So you can go on, you can download the program on, we'll put it in the show notes too. You can go through and get an idea of what this is. So if you're just listening and you're like, I really want to know more about this, I don't necessarily want to commit by either becoming a nurse or becoming full-time forensic nurse, but I want to know more about this process. It's completely free and a wonderful resource. Lots of videos and interactive stuff, and you can do tests along the way if you choose to. But yeah, I can't say enough good things about it. It seemed really foreign to me when I was first given that task, like make something about a video. And through the course of interviews and, you know, going through it myself, it's such an invaluable resource.
Yes. And any institute or organization that offers any sort of forensic training, dive into it. Go to it, because it will open your eyes about how prevalent and how needed these services in hospitals and communities are, because it's just needed nationwide and internationally, right, as well too. We need more forensic nursing.
So Sean, tell us a little bit more about what your call to action for our followers would be.
So I actually have two. My first call to action is for healthcare. Does not matter what role in healthcare that you have. Start having those conversations in your unit, on your floor, wherever you work, about sexual assault, domestic violence, trafficking, and stalking. Have those talks. Seek the education and bring it to people that you work with, because unfortunately, healthcare historically has not done an overall good job identifying a lot of these things here. So that's my call to action for healthcare. My second one is really to everyone else. don't be afraid to have those hard talks with friends and family members and people that you work with about issues you care about. If you care about sexual assault patients and victims, DV, stalking, and trafficking, and you want to bring awareness to your community, your friends, don't be afraid to do it. Use your voice. And there are plenty of agencies that are in, that are out in the public that can always, always use your voice with this as well too. So don't be afraid to get out there and talk about it to your comfort level.
I love those as a call to action because no one can do everything, but everyone can do something. And so if you're listening to this and you feel passionate, it really is just as simple sometimes as having these conversations and showing yourself as a safe space for the people around you. Because if you're already having these difficult conversations and you have someone that you love that goes through something difficult, they're not going to be afraid to have these conversations with you. So I love that. I think that's such an important healing call to action for so many people. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
Sean, tell us more about where we can find you, how our followers can follow you as well, because I know you're active on social media.
So I am on Instagram. I am the Sane Corner, all one word. I do a lot of education posts right on that about kind of what the role is, kind of what we see about certain things that forensic nurses do and see. Feel free to follow me there. Website is being created. Don't have one yet, but it's being in the process. And those are, that's how you can follow me and reach out to me.
We'll always be sure to link those in our show notes. Check there. You'll see us repost stuff from Sean all the time too, because we absolutely love it. But I can't thank you enough. I have a feeling we will probably have you back on because we're going to get a whole rash of new questions now too. But Sean, thank you. This is so fun.
Thank you both for having me on. Thank you.
Of course.
Survivor's Guide to True Crime is hosted and executive produced by Kimberly Corbin Rourke and Kara Robinson Chamberlain.
If you love what we do here, please don't forget to follow, rate, and review the show in your podcast player. It's an easy and free way to help us and help more people find the show.
To learn more about the guests featured or to find resources and information discussed on the show, visit survivorsguidetotruecrime.com.
Thanks for listening.
Well, see you later.
Haha, we did it.
Yay.
Good for us.
Good for us.